Latino Organization's annual convention gets underway today in Milwaukee. It's drawing a handful of Democratic presidential candidates to our state. We're looking at the influence of Latino voters. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Pew, Hispanics are expected to surpass African Americans as the largest ethnic or racial minority in our voting population. Have you worked to organize Hispanic voters or get more people registered to vote? What challenges have you encountered? We're at 800-642-1234. Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and the Washington bureau chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Craig, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Nice to be with you.
Well, let's spend a moment here on that Pew research with expecting eligible Hispanic voters to outnumber African Americans next year. How significant is that for Democratic hopefuls?
Well, the thing about this group of voters, obviously it's growing. It could grow more. It's kind of underperforming in the sense that it turns out at lower levels. Latino voters overall turn out at lower levels than African-American voters and white voters. And partly that's demographic. It's a younger population, so you have fewer eligible voters, you have more non-citizens, but also just the rate of turnout rate among eligible Latino voters is not as high as it could be. The other thing about it is that it's not like evenly distributed across the country. I mean, it's a much bigger factor in some states than others. A lot of states like Wisconsin, it's basically 5% or less of the eligible vote. But, you know, some states, California, Texas, Florida, New Mexico, Nevada, it's 20% or more. So the impact in a presidential race and the impact in, you know, Senate races is profoundly different from state to state.
Well, there's been some polling on this last month from Univision Network. What did we find there from the polling data?
Well, they had polling on the Democratic presidential race, and they've also had, you know, continuous and ongoing polling on attitudes toward President Trump and attitudes toward issues. We can talk about either one of those. I would say President Trump's approval ratings are poor among Latino voters overall. They had him at about 25% approval, and the percentage of people that said they would vote for him in 2020 for reelection was even lower. It was about 21%. So his numbers are not good. You know, it shows that while Latino voters care a lot about border and immigration issues, they also care just as much or more about economic issues and health care. It's an interesting electorate. It's not monolithic. I mean, you have you have variations, for example, even with respect to attitudes toward President Trump, where his numbers are even worse than the numbers I cited for you among women, among younger Latinos, among first-generation Latinos. The first-generation Americans in the Latino population, they're not quite as bad among male Latinos and older Latinos and higher-income Latinos. And then there's groups like Cuban Americans, which are concentrated in Florida, which tend to be more Republican, whereas numbers are better than they are with the population as a whole. So it's not a monolithic group, and there's even some levels of support for stronger border enforcement among Latino voters, but the rhetoric coming from President Trump, I think, has pushed his numbers down below even the levels of support for things like a border wall among Latino voters.
So is 2020 a different environment than in 2016? What does polling tell us about what the environment is like here heading into 2020?
Yeah, I think, well, obviously the election will answer that question. I think it potentially it's a different environment because while you had in 2016, Donald Trump running with a lot of fiery rhetoric and a lot of rhetoric that turned off a lot of Latino voters, he wasn't the president. And so now you have the possibility for higher turnout levels because he's the president, because he's such a focus of everything. And we don't know whether his share of the vote is going to be higher or lower than it was in 2016. We're pretty sure it's going to be lower than it was, for example, for George W. Bush when he was running for re-election, which was kind of a high watermark in recent decades for a Republican president, where he was thought to get close to 40% of the Hispanic or Latino vote. It's not going to be anything like that. Turnout is going to be a huge question, and turnout in particular states is going to be a huge question for president, because again, when you look at the number of states that are potentially pivotal in the Electoral College that have a significant Latino vote, you're really talking first and foremost about Florida and Arizona,
mm-hmm.
And Nevada. I would say that's the third one. Those are the states that could be difference makers in the Electoral College that have a significant Latino vote.
Talking with Craig Gilbert, Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. How do you think President Trump or the Democratic presidential candidates should be connecting with Hispanic voters before next year's election? Are you a Latino voter? What issues do you want to see the candidates talking about? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Craig, you mentioned the border. What issues do we know are front and center for Latinos in the presidential election?
Well, in the most recent polling, I said the three issues that really stand out are the economy, healthcare, and immigration and border issues. And so immigration and border issues probably have a higher salience among Latino voters than they do have as the population as a whole, but certainly wages and jobs and the cost of healthcare are huge issues as well. And they could fit, you know, play into this dynamic we're talking about in terms with respect to, I mean, we know that healthcare is potentially a big issue in this campaign. There's some court cases that could make it an even bigger issue. So that's something to watch as well.
We've seen a number of Democrats speaking Spanish on the stage behind podiums. What challenges do Democrats face in connecting with these voters?
Yeah, the first set of Democratic debates in Miami, of course, it was Miami, and you also had someone from the Spanish language media participating in the debate as a moderator, and you had at least four Democratic candidates kind of breaking into Spanish, even in at times that were kind of surprising, and that tells you a lot about how Democratic candidates see the importance of that vote. But they do have challenges. I mean, certainly, you know, one of the findings in the recent polling is that, you know, there are a lot of Latino voters do think that some Democrats and some Democratic leaders have taken their votes for granted. They haven't seen action on, you know, they haven't seen comprehensive action on immigration policy, even when Democrats controlled Washington in the first few years of the Obama presidency. So, you know, Democrats have something to prove, even though they perceive Democrats as being kind of doing more outreach and being more open to their issues than Republicans.
Craig, as we wrap up here, some Democratic candidates are expected to appear in Milwaukee this week for that convention organized by the League of United Latin American Citizens. Do we know yet if any of these candidates face bigger challenges connecting with Hispanic voters?
Well, I mentioned that there's been some polling. Actually, it was in the aftermath of the Miami debate about the Democratic presidential field. The two candidates that could have sort of stood out in the polling were Julian Castro, who's the only real major Latino candidate in the field from Texas, and Kamala Harris, the senator from California, who was seen as having a really good debate, and she kind of advanced among voters across the board. But it's a totally wide open, I think, arena for these candidates. I mean, there's no one candidate that dominates that voting group. And just as it's an open-ended race, it's an open-ended race among Latino voters as well.
Craig, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Craig Gilbert is a political reporter and the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And later this afternoon on Central Time, we'll talk with a representative from the League of United Latin American Citizens about the importance of Latino voters in 2020 and how that factors into the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee. That's coming up after 3 here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. We're talking about DNA testing and picking up after your dog. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So picture this. You're out in your neighborhood, sun shining, it's beautiful, and then squish. You just stepped in dog poop that didn't get cleaned up. And so companies now use DNA to figure out which dog owners failed to scoop up. Some apartment complexes now ask for a dog DNA swab to track down violating owners. Did you share your dog's DNA as part of your lease? Are you on board or do you worry that it's a privacy overreach? Would you like to see this in your neighborhood? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Anna Schlesher is owner of Poo Prints Wisconsin. That's a company that collects the DNA of dogs for waste management. Anna, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So picking up after your dog seems like the right thing to do, but some people don't do it. What kind of challenges can waste pose?
Well, first off, it's an eyesore. You don't want to walk onto your property and see dog waste everywhere. It washes into our lakes and streams, and it's a health hazard.
So who is relying on these types of services? How are they spreading?
I mainly service apartment complexes, HOAs, and condominium associations, so planned communities.
And so when they reach out to you, what are they wanting? Why are they asking for your services?
Reduction in waste. Tenants just not picking up after themselves. They would like to alleviate that problem.
And how big of a problem is it? What are you seeing out there?
It's huge. I went to an apartment complex about a week ago, and the poop on their courtyard was so bad that they couldn't use it.
So how exactly does the process work for companies like yours? Take us through the steps.
It's a simple cheek swab for each dog on your property, and then we register them in our World Pet Registry, so they have their DNA and catalog. And then when you find unscooped waste on your property, we can match it to who made it.
Oh, so you pick it up and you send the sample in? How does that work?
You take a nickel-sized piece of the sample that you find on the ground, and then you put it in a vial that we provide. You shake it up really well and send it into our lab.
And then what happens at your lab?
We run it through a 16-point match system to match it to the cheek swab that we have from the dogs on your property.
How often does this happen? How robust is business?
It's really taking off. I have about 100 communities in Wisconsin right now.
And when did you get into this business? What led you to work in this career?
I am a property manager, and we were having huge waste issues on our property. We were stepping in waste on showings. It was embarrassing. It was really bad for the good dog owners, too. So we were looking for a solution, and we found this. And we had 99% reduction in waste, and it was unbelievable. So I thought that this program could help other community owners in the area, which it really has.
So you saw a significant drop. Is it because dog owners were suddenly a bit fearful of being able to be, called out when they're not picking up after their pet? Or what was going on there when you saw this reduction?
It's an accountability program. So, yeah, I don't know if fearful is the right word, but, yeah, now we can tell it was you, definitively prove it was you. So people pick up.
We're talking with Anna Schlesher. She is owner of Poo Prints Wisconsin. It's a company that collects the DNA of dogs for waste management. Did you have to share your dog's DNA as part of your lease agreement? Are you on board or are you concerned that it's a privacy overreach? Would you like to see this in your community, in your neighborhood? And landlords, do you do this already? What has this meant for your property? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Anna, how many groups in the state use your service about, and is this growing?
Yes, it is growing. Last year, we grew more than any other year, and we have about 100 communities in the state right now.
And is this something that we're seeing across the country for apartment complexes and condos? Is this a step in the lease agreement?
Yes, for many of them it is. We are in every state and Canada, it's really been taking off.
So what is the cost for this service?
For new communities, it is $34.95 per dog to get them registered. There is no annual maintenance fee or contracts. So once we get all of your dogs registered, when you find waste, the waste sample collection kit is $20 and lab processing is $59.95. So it's about $80 to send in a waste sample. But generally, communities charge fines higher than $80. So that cost is really covered. And hopefully you don't have too many to send in.
And so what you're seeing there is the fine that is then covered. You cover the cost of sending in that sample with the fine you're charging for the offender. Is that how communities do it?
Yes. Yep.
What are the concerns that people have about collecting their dog's DNA?
You know, quite honestly, the pushback that we've had from this program has been really small. Smaller than I thought it would be when we first rolled it out. I did have somebody, one tenant so far, tell me, you know, you can't take my dog's DNA, your dog is not a protected class in its terms of your lease. I did have another gentleman tell me that we were going to dig poop out of the waste bucket and sample it to find him. And I told him the goal of this program was to touch less poop, not more poop.
So some questions out there. Let's go to Alex now in Appleton. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I just have a comment. You know, I'm a homeowner, and so I have a lawn that I have to mow. And I really think people, when they have their dogs, they should potty their dogs in their own yard. People know that when they feed their dog, they know when their dog is going to poo. I have friends who are dog owners. They can time it pretty much. Because even when someone thinks they're being a good dog owner and picking it up off my yard, there's still residue that I step in, I can smell, and I run over it with my lawnmower. And I don't think that's right. I don't take my cats, scoop their litter box, and throw it on your yard and then try and pick it back up. So take care of your pets on your own property. And I feel for the people who live in apartment complexes, and I'm completely for this, you know, keeping them accountable. Because once your dog poos, even if it's your property, you should pick it up right away. Don't let it sit there all week.
Alex, thanks so much for the call. What are your thoughts there, Anna?
Well, I would agree with you. You know, it washes into our lakes and streams. I think people should be picking it up right away. And this program ensures that they do.
What does this service mean for your clients? What kind of results are they seeing and telling you?
We have had wonderful results. The company that I rolled it out in, the one I mentioned a little bit ago, they can use their courtyard again, which is amazing. And I find that good dog owners really love this program too, because it means that people who weren't picking up before and they had to deal with it are now picking up waste. So it's been great.
Is there an issue, do you see, in terms of these apartment complexes where there just isn't enough property where, you know, a dog can do its business? Is that an issue?
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I think generally pet-friendly communities have planned that pretty well.
So how does addressing privacy here with the people who have issues with you taking that swab of DNA, you know, where are we at with privacy and our pets?
Dogs aren't a protected class, so... I don't think there is an issue there. And again, the pushback has been very small.
And you are Poo Prints Wisconsin. Is that that's a franchise company? Is that around the country?
It is, yeah. Our lab is based in Knoxville.
Knoxville, Tennessee?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it has certainly a franchise structure. When you talk with a fellow franchise owners around the nation, what are some issues that they see come up, and what are they addressing?
That's a good question. I think maybe the biggest issue where this program does not work is when you don't have all of the dogs registered on your properties. So if you have a dog that you've been sending in waste samples and there's just no matches for all this poop that's clearly come off of the same dog, because we can tell. So once they get that dog registered, we go back and test old waste samples that didn't match any of the dogs on your property about every 2 weeks or so. And we've had a pretty good success rate in eventually catching those people. So I'd say that's probably the biggest flaw, but that's, you know, you can mitigate.
Anna, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Anna Schlesher is owner of Poo Prints Wisconsin. That's a company that collects the DNA of dogs for waste management. Coming up, it's news, then we'll meet the new host of Wisconsin Foodie, a James Beard-nominated chef who hails from Broqua. I want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What local food needs to be celebrated in your area? What's your favorite restaurant, your favorite local cafe or bakery? What farmer's market do you frequent? Join in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Stay with us. We'll be back after a news update right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the show Wisconsin Foodie, which airs on Wisconsin Public Television. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. The upcoming season has a new face in the kitchen with Chef Luke Zahm. Are you a fan of Wisconsin Foodie? What do you love about the show? What do you want to see in the future? We're at 800-642-1234 for you to join in. Luke Zahm is a James Beard-nominated chef and owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, and he replaces Kyle Cherik, who hosted the show for 11 years. Luke, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Thanks for the opportunity.
And Arthur Ersink is here. He's the founder and executive producer of Wisconsin Foodie. Arthur, welcome to you.
Good morning.
So, Luke, let's start with you. You were a guest on Wisconsin Foodie before you became the new host. What interested you in this opportunity?
Sure. I think really helping to reinforce the Wisconsin identity. I grew up, actually, in a really small town, Lafarge, population 745. And I promised myself, actually, that I was going to make sure that I said Lafarge out loud.
You did. Got it.
But, you know, I really felt strongly that, you know, growing up, being from a rural area in Wisconsin, I spent a lot of my time feeling a little bit marginalized. Being from some place that is often described as, you know, kind of between Chicago and Minneapolis, or for maybe people in Wisconsin familiar, it's somewhere between Madison and La Crosse. That identity of being from a small town and having that be important really came into significance for me when Arthur showed up the first time. And I got a lot of feedback from people in the community that it was important to tell the story of who I was and where I was from in the hope of creating an identity for people who live there now and are growing up in rural America. So that became kind of my my MO, so to speak, to really evangelize.
What can we learn about the food coming out of rural America?
I think we can learn a lot. I mean, I think that there is a beautiful transition happening right now where rural America is starting to feel more empowered, more recognized. But I think, you know, some of the things that we capture are the cultural exchanges that happen. Even in Wisconsin, you know, going through some of the programming for this year, we're going to a cheesemaker who has Oaxacan background and then going to a really small butcher shop in a small town in Wisconsin. And they're teaching each other about the craft that each one of them holds and celebrates. And they literally are holding a line, so to speak, for their culture. But in that, there's a lot of crossover. And I think that that's what's beautiful about what's happening in food in the upper Midwest right now.
So, Arthur, the program selected a chef as a new host. Why did you go that direction?
You know, I think, you know, it was more than just a chef. It was what Luke, you know, brings to the table. I think, you know, as a producer, you know, I rely on my gut a lot, and not to make a silly food pun, but...
we like puns.
But no, I think there's just there's a feeling that you get when something's right, when something is magical. And I think I first got that feeling when I went to the Viroqua area. Early in the early days of Wisconsin Foodie, we would travel. All we had was a map of Wisconsin, but it was a cheese map. And that's how we would travel around Wisconsin. And we would routinely get lost because, you know, cell phones weren't as smart as they were now, you know, as they are now. But so we would look at the wheel of cheese and which cheese are we on right now, you know, and we started to get lost over in that area. But then we discovered the Driftless area, and it was just unbelievably gorgeous out there. And there was something, you just knew there was something special there. And from there, we discovered the Driftless Cafe. From that moment, you know, first working with Luke, I knew there was going to be a relationship somewhere down the line.
Do you see an advantage of having a chef talk with other chefs?
I see a big advantage with a chef talking with other chefs, but also somebody that's so connected to the rural part of the state and just that culture. I think it's critical for the show to have somebody that's such a great ambassador for agriculture, for dairy farming, small dairy farming. I think that's critical for us, and it was really kind of the impetus for us bringing him in.
Our guests for the rest of this hour are from Wisconsin Foodie, the public television show. Luke Zahm, a chef from Viroqua, is the program's new host. Arthur Ersink is here. He's executive producer. What questions do you have about Wisconsin Foodie or about the state's uncovered food scene? Perhaps you have a map of cheese in Wisconsin. Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Luke, what is happening at Driftless Cafe when you are working on the show? Because it sounds like you've got two different universes here.
It's quite a dichotomy, for sure. No, I think I hit the chef jackpot. And in true like Viroqua Driftless fashion, it was magical. Mary Castman, who is a graduate of Madison College here and also a graduate of UW, was living. She moved from Boston. She has a daughter, Alice, and a husband, Eric, and they had moved to Viroqua because they didn't feel comfortable raising Alice in Boston. They wanted something that was a little slower paced. It just so happens that she had been working at Oleana in Boston, which is a James Beard Award-winning restaurant, and then Sarma, which is a perennial nominee and finalist in the James Beard category. And I ran into her one day in the co-op, and I was like, hey, you know, if you ever just want to, you know, come in and swing a knife, the door is always open. And literally, we sat down, and we had one conversation, and I think personality-wise, which is so important, we clicked. So now the story of the Driftless Cafe, she has a strong leaning into Mediterranean and Middle Eastern food. And I think that there's this beautiful cross-cultural thing going on where we're doing this Middle East meets Midwest. Mm-hmm. So all the ingredients are the same. We're still sourcing from all of our local farmers. But we have this different spin on it. And I think it's my job to empower her and kind of back off a little bit. So I'm there and I'm around, and it's takes some acclimation. But right now, my focus is on making a television show that tells the story of who we are and where we're from.
You're out shooting,
yeah.
And your season will unfold in January, the new season. So what are you learning from this new hosting gig?
First and foremost, I'm learning that making television is really hard. The things that people take for granted, like we want to walk in the door, you know, I can screw that up more times than I ever thought possible. You know, so that like 20 takes to walk into one restaurant until I get it right. That's a little bit different. I didn't actually realize that about the television making process. I'm learning a lot about asking questions and trying to help people kind of move from one segment of their thought to another to give the show, you know, more fluidity. That's something that you as a journalist understand and, you know, take in as part of your daily MO. But for me, I'm actually really fascinated by what people are saying. I'm also learning that when I show up on a shoot, I can't ask all the questions that I want to ask right away because I would really want it to be a natural conversation process. Like, oh my gosh, this is so great. I am so excited about what you're doing. And usually the producers are telling me to like go in the back and be quiet until they get the camera set up and rolling and then ask the questions. So there's an air of authenticity. I'm learning a lot about that, but it's literally a riot to be able to be in this place that I love and care so deeply for, and you know, be able to tell a story that reflects my identity and the people of this state, and try and create something that has substantive meaning and authenticity. I don't know if there's a higher calling for a person like me.
Arthur, what types of diversity and stories are you uncovering for this next season? Can you give us a taste?
For, you know, so we, you know, with Wisconsin Foodie, we're really sensitive to geography. We're sensitive to different cultures, different foods. And I think that goes into the whole brainstorming process of we know we want to get to certain parts of Wisconsin because we want to serve everybody. We want to tell the stories from the whole state. Us being from Milwaukee, Luke being from the Driftless area now, you know, but especially us being from Milwaukee, we're around all these great stories every single day in Milwaukee, and we have to push ourselves outside of that little box and search for great stories all the way north, all the way west, all the way east, in the middle of the state, because if we don't, we hear from our viewers, you know, to that we need to get out more, that we need to do less of Milwaukee, less of Madison. So you know, for this season, where there's a lot of, we always love the traditional stories. You know, we were recently in Sheboygan and we want to tell the story of, the hard roll, Sheboygan hard roll. And while we're there, we, you know, it's funny.
Because what's the deal with the Sheboygan hard roll?
Sheboygan hard roll. Yeah. So the Sheboygan hard roll is just this like famous roll that pretty much goes bad within the next day. If you don't eat it like right out of the oven, it just goes bad. But it's this hard, crispy roll on the outside and soft, flaky, doughy bun on the inside. And a lot of Sheboyganers will eat brats on the hard roll, but it's not a traditional, you know, brat bun. It's a hard roll. So they'll eat two brats on the hard
brat.
Roll.
What's up,
the double brat? You know, so we ate several double brats. You know, because it's acceptable in Sheboygan. But you know, but then we met Fuzzy. You know, Fuzzy is this longtime old school, you know, hard roll maker, and that's like the one thing he did really well in his life,
yep.
You know, is make these hard rolls.
Have you picked up some tips along the way from Fuzzy and others?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, so going through that shoot, I can say this, like the thing that's amazing about this place is like literally we get into a location and we could have made half a season on Sheboygan. I mean, it's just when you're in a place and you see it and it comes at you naturally, like we could do a story about that, and that's captivating. But yeah, we actually did a couple bakeries, and we were at City Bakery in the morning. And so the idea was I was going to go in with Rick, the owner, and you know, master hard roll maker. And to be in a working, functioning bakery like that, it's clockwork. Everything is calculated. Every movement is, you know, precise. And then you've got some guy like, what can I do now? You know, like trying to like get involved, but at the same time not get in the way.
Uh-huh.
With the pressure of like, we're going to put cameras on this. And it was amazing. It was truly, truly amazing. I'm picking up tips everywhere I go.
Talking about this show, Wisconsin Foodie, airing on Wisconsin Public Television. New season in January. We'll have a new host with Luke Zahm. He is chef from Viroqua. Stays with us, and Arthur Ersink is the show's executive producer. So what should people know about Wisconsin's food scene where you are? What local treats should be the state encouraging? Which chefs are doing creative things in your community? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back for more in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about the show Wisconsin Foodie that airs on Wisconsin Public Television. Has a new host for the upcoming season starting in January. Here's a bit of a preview from the show's trailer.
The food has been picked. We've taken it back to the cafe. We've done our preparations, and now we're ready to make sure that the love and care that these farmers have put into growing this food is translated into the dinner service. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks.
What questions do you have about Wisconsin Foodie? What do you want to know about the program's new host or its history? Join in at 800-642-1234. Luke Zahm is that new chef, new host. He's a chef from Viroqua. He's also the program's new host. And Arthur Ersink is the show's executive producer. They stay with us. Let's go to the phones now with John joining us from Wanakee. Hi, John.
Hey, guys. First, Driftless Cafe is just an absolute gem. It's an amazing place. The food is so good, so unprecious, so authentic. So just really, thanks for having that there.
I think Luke is basking.
I'm not. Wait, you had this guy call in. This is a setup, isn't it?
No, dude, seriously, I mean, it's so good. And I spent some time out there because I do fly fishing in the trout streams out there. And, you know, the whole, you know, Chez-Panisse farm-to-table deal that is really kind of organic to that rural area is so cool. One suggestion for the show is, you know, highlight like the farms or the resources that you're going to, so that, you know, you go to you can go and say, hey, this farm produces really great, you know, grass-fed beef or, you know, free-range chicken or whatever it is, so that folks can kind of avail themselves to that resource directly. Mm. It's just, and I'm sure the show already does that, but, you know, just, you know, a link on a website or at the bottom or just, because I think the local farmers and local, you know, kind of food artisans would really get off on that. I mean,
John, that's a great suggestion.
Yeah, John, thanks so much. Yeah. And Arthur, how would you feel that getting to the farms more often?
I'm all about promoting the farms, the farmers. I mean, that is really kind of the core of what we try to do. Being a television producer, you know your limits with how much people want to watch a story about a farm, you know, so we've kind of dialed it in, but we make sure we do tell those stories, but, you know, they're bits of segments, and it's some farmers aren't set up to necessarily, you know, sell directly to, you know, residents or, you know, folks, you know, outside of the, you know, grocery world or the chefing world, but we highlight the farms and then we highlight the restaurants or potentially the grocery stores where they can find those products, mm-hmm. To make it a little bit more accessible. But I love the idea of connecting our viewers more with the farms and where they can find that food online. I think that's a big focus for us going forward, this kind of interactivity.
Yeah, that locally sourced.
Yeah. And John, thanks so much for the
feedback.
The props, seriously.
Did you know there's only one Wanake in the world?
I did know that. Okay. I did know. They have a sign, actually, outside Wanake that says, this is the only one in the world, which is fantastic. But, you know, I think speaking to Arthur's point, we have so many plans for the website, for interactivity, for things that don't make shows. Mm-hmm. You know, literally, we can go through and do tutorials, cooking segments. I think that that's one of the pieces that I really have an interest in, showing how to use these amazing ingredients and give them a life and a story that maybe the program segment can't capture accurately, but we can grow into.
You know, for us, it's more of a movement than it is an entertainment show. You know, we're trying to create something here. We're trying to create a mass of people that are really more conscious about the food that they're eating, the people they're supporting, and that kind of local economy. So for us, we're just trying to, you know, to make that happen through television.
Right.
Let's go to Kelly now in Cascade. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Arthur, I think my husband and I met you at the Shorewood Farmers Market.
Awesome.
So we opened, my husband and I have started something, it's called the Nurturing Heart, and we are just 45 minutes north of Milwaukee.
What's your husband's name?
His Tim.
Tim, yeah. I love you guys. I want to put you on TV. I think I sent you a message on Facebook saying like, let's do this. I want to do a show about you guys.
Wait, so. Did you plan this call?
So we totally got turned on to the slow food movement, and I have a website, Slow and Simple Living, so I'm really just jazzed about it and jazzed about the whole food scene here
people
in Wisconsin.
Anybody listening should go on Facebook and follow, and not to do a call out, but like you guys post, like your posts on Facebook are just magical. And I knew Tim's plans was to open like a bed and breakfast or, you know, did that ever come to fruition?
That's great. We have a beautiful Cream City Brick 1885 farmhouse, which is full of all kinds of experiences, the good, the bad, and the ugly with an old house. But we've got a 5-acre spot, but we're surrounded by a lot of agriculture land.
That's great.
And we're 45 minutes outside of the city, so we're accessible from Milwaukee. But we're really creating just an intimate dining experience. If people want to feel like they're
out on the farm but don't want to drive really far away, or also want to feel like they're traveling to Italy but don't have to take a plane.
You can't do anybody else's television show but ours first, okay? So if John McGivern calls you, you cannot do the John McGivern show. You have to do Wisconsin Foodie first. We're the first ones because we're here talking. We're the first, and then you know, the sea of people will come.
Well, we have to move on from this love fest. Kelly, thank you so much. Let's go to Tom now in Turtle Lake. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, Tom.
I just wanted to say I had a suggestion for your guest today. The hotel bar in downtown Turtle Lake in the far northwestern corner of Wisconsin is coming up on its 100th year of operation, and they have an absolutely awesome bourbon burger.
Did you say bourbon burger?
Yeah, those are like two of my favorite
mine
things.
Yep, exactly.
Awesome. Well, thank you for the tip, Tom. That's great.
Where is Turtle Lake?
So Turtle Lake is about an hour and a half north of Eau Claire. So you're familiar with Rice Lake. It's about due west. So it's pretty hard to be much farther west and still be in Wisconsin.
That's fantastic.
Tom, thanks so much for the tip. Luke, what about burgers? What are you finding out there in Wisconsin?
What about burgers? So like burgers for me are the litmus test, right? Because to be fair, there's so much good food in the state, but like you can really judge a restaurant by its burger. So this is kind of a shout out to anyone listening who is a food service operator. A burger has all the nuance. Like you can go and you can get it super fancy. You can get people who really, we do coffee onions or we have our special sauce that we do. But just about every bar and grill in the state has a burger. And I think sometimes simple is better. I think that there is room for the whole spectrum of burgers. Sometimes you want that like Wagyu beef, like, oh my gosh, this is a $20 burger and so decadent. Sometimes you want that, smash patty with, the Wisconsin cheese and it's just kind of ooey gooey and it feels like, hedonism a little bit. Like, I know this isn't good for me, but I'm going to do it anyway because that's the nature of the burger. So I think that the opportunity to kind of eat that and see into the mind of the establishment, I can really tell a lot about a chef and the person that's back by their burger.
What do you think? What, you got a favorite one?
Man, I don't know. Like name dropping a burger on Wisconsin Public Radio like that.
Stakes are high.
The stakes are high. No, I think that there's some fantastic ones.
Dodging it. So Arthur, you've worked on Wisconsin Foodie for more than a decade. What big changes have you seen in the food scene here in Wisconsin as you've worked on this project?
Oh, I've seen just the restaurant industry explode. Like I think the amount of restaurants and the amount of restaurants in Madison, Milwaukee, and then on the outside of those communities have just really exploded. And part of that makes me a little nervous because I think we're running into a lot of these restaurants are starting to run into staffing issues. I think that's a really big kind of crisis in the restaurant industry is having proper chefs and staff. But also awareness of food, awareness of products, awareness of local and Wisconsin products. That is the biggest change I've seen in the past 10 years, and that makes me really excited.
Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
This was fun. Luke Zahm is owner of the Driftless Cafe in Viroqua, the new host of Wisconsin Foodie, and Arthur Ersink is the program's founder and executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.